Hello, this is David Starr. Welcome to another great episode of the Pluralcast. Well, there's certainly a lot going on here at Pluralcast World Headquarters. We're gearing up for TechEd here at Pluralsight. And one of the things that means is that I get to actually do my TechEd session in a preview to some Microsoft folks who want to make sure that it's good enough to actually go on stage. That's a really great thing. That means that TechEd attendees are for sure going to be getting some very high quality content and sessions. And given that this TechEd is in New Orleans, Louisiana, who wouldn't want to go? I am so excited about this one because my wife and I are dropping our four kids off with my parents in Texas, and we're going to go on over to New Orleans together and have an actual sort of kind of vacation after many years of not taking one. And let's face it, who doesn't love some time off in New Orleans? Now, I know that we're getting near the end of the crawfish season, but there's still going to be plenty of etouffee for everybody. Let's turn our attention to today's discussion with Dan Sullivan. And wow, I gotta say, before you hear this, I'm just blown away by Dan's in-depth knowledge and insight into database theory history, and all sorts of things about SQL Server I think we really don't think about when we just use SQL Server as our storage mechanism building line of business applications. There's a lot going on inside that little box, and Dan does a great job of explaining some of those higher level or lower level concepts to us mere mortals. Dan is a member of the technical staff at Pluralsight, where he heads up the SQL Server curriculum, and he also produces most of our Pluralsight on-demand online content for SQL Server. Dan has co-authored SQL Server books in the past and written for the likes of MSDN Magazine, SQL Server Magazine. He's a frequent speaker at conferences and just an all-around great guy. Now, I didn't really have an agenda walking into this discussion. I just really wanted Dan to help me understand some new things about SQL Server that maybe I didn't know before. And this is where we started.
Well, the first thing to think about, I think, when you look at SQL Server is that it's a concurrent runtime. If you want to write concurrent applications, code that's running concurrently, what people call multi-threaded, think of it as an operating system for concurrent applications, because that's what it is. All the problems have been solved. They were solved 20 years ago, and SQL Server implements them. So all these things we talk about, you know, all these neat things we're going to do, use locks in certain ways like that, you do it mindlessly with SQL Server. That's what it, under the covers, that's basically what it is. You can have multiple threads running, accessing the same resources at nominally the same time without getting into trouble because the underlying system manages all the concurrency.
Well, but if I hear you right, you're describing a really efficient model for data manipulation, but you're talking about it as a higher level thing. You're talking about it as a programming platform.
Yeah, think about Service Broker, which has kind of gotten forgotten.
Okay.
If you think about workflow, of course, the Windows workflow, or I guess it's not workflow because they couldn't call it WWF. They tried, but it didn't work. Think about Windows workflow. You have tasks that have to get run and they nominally run together, but they don't really. If you really want to get high bandwidth things like that working, Service Broker does it. There aren't really any tools to make it easy to use it. That's the only deficiency. It got shortchanged. It's an amazing platform. Just talking about making applications, you have things that have to get done. There are certain rules for how they have to interact with each other, and you want to bang on them as hard as possible. That's what Service Broker does for you. And it's basically, sometimes these have a name which I think are called sometimes lightweight transactions because in effect that's what they are. Sometimes they do things like what are you familiar with the term business transactions or sagas?
Sure.
Yeah, well, basically, one of the things you can do easily with Service Broker is sagas, because it will remember every single thing you did and allow you to undo it. The problem with the saga is you have to figure out how to undo what you did. In a nutshell, you have transactions. It says, do things, and it will be as though everybody was working independently, even though they're all working at exactly the same time. And the problem with that in real life is transactions have to be completed in fractions of a millisecond, fractions of a microsecond. Otherwise, things won't work. Real-life business transactions don't take place that quickly. The example I usually think of is when you're trying to set up a production line, because I've done stuff like that in the past, where when you set up a production line, you go through a process called kitting. And the kitting says, I want to build 500 of these things today. What parts do I need to do it? And I want to build 500 of these other things today, too. What parts do I need to do it? Maybe some of those two things are using the same parts, and there aren't enough to do both. So as you go through the process of kitting, checking all the stock rooms, you find that at some point there aren't enough parts to do something, but you've already committed some things, and you have to undo all those commitments. So that's what you do in a quote business transaction. You undo those transactions through a compensating resource manager, right? You go back and say, these are the things I did. This is how I can walk this out. It's not quite like a transaction because you end up doing things you might not have done before. And in the process of doing things, you might prevent other things from happening, but it's a way of doing real life things. So anyhow, yeah, under the covers, basically, SQL Server is a platform that says, tell me what you want to do, and I'll figure out how to apply the 20 or 30 different kinds of locks I have to resources to make that work without tripping all over yourself. That's in essence what it does.
And there's still use, though, in higher-level constructs that accomplish similar things, right? We have big event service buses that give us similar functionality, and even WebF long-running workflows as an example.
Sure, absolutely. And in fact, they kind of do the same thing because you can always recover from the workflow because you know everything you did. But if you're really talking about things that are going to do high transaction rates, Service Broker can probably beat them. The trouble is, as I said, there are no tools to support doing all the things you have to do to make it work. I mean, what's the core of SQL Server when you think about all the things that it's doing? Well, two things have to be able to access the same resource at the same time and not turn it into mush. Basically, that's what it has to be able to do. And how are you going to do that? Well, a long time ago, people like Gray and Reuter figured out the only way you can do it is with locks. And the dumbest kind of lock is to say, I own all the resources till I'm done. And when I'm done, you can own all the resources till you're done. That's called serialization. That's called isolation level serializable. Not very efficient. But they found out if you have a whole set of locks that are really, really clever about how they get applied, you can actually do things like saying, well, you know, I'm actually only using resources 1, 2, and 3, and I never touch 4, 5, and 6. So if you want to use those, go ahead. The locks won't interfere with each other. And under the cover, SQL Server manages that for you. So when you do a transaction, one of the things you always specify along with doing a transaction is the isolation level. And what does that mean? It means how aggressively you want to apply the various kinds of locks to make sure you don't trip all over yourself. If you pick isolation level serializable, you can mindlessly go and write code, and you will not turn things into mush. Cannot happen. It won't be as fast as if you pick isolation level, say, repeatable read, for example. But when you write your code, you have to take into account that certain things, like things might get added to a table between the time you start your transaction and end it, and that could confuse you, but as long as you take care of that in your code, you're okay. In fact, the way I think about it is, when you use isolation level serializable, you're depending on Codd. He's the guy who invented relational databases, the mathematical underpinnings for why they work. When you use any other isolation level, you're depending on code to write it the right way, so that, in fact, the things that can go wrong don't affect you because you know how you're using the data. So under the covers, SQL Server is just this really sophisticated lock manager. That's really what it is. And when you do things like with workflow, you do have locks, and there's locks you can apply to things. But you can still run into problems or run real slow, depending on how you apply those locks, by blocking a whole workflow in the process of grabbing something and saying, I own the lock and you can't touch it. SQL Server is much more sophisticated because, of course, it completely understands the language you're using. You're using T-SQL. It parses it. It knows every single thing that happens. So at the instruction level, even at the fraction of an instruction level, it knows what's going to happen. So it can be much, much more clever about applying locks. When you're writing workflows with something like C#, although in theory you could parse it and understand everything because everything is there in the IL, it's really much too complicated to do that, so you don't. So you take kind of a much more defensive attitude towards applying locks. So yeah, it's basically this platform for writing concurrent applications. And it turns out the principal thing people think about is writing applications with transactions. And when you write concurrent applications, the thing you're always thinking about is, am I going to turn my data into mush? How do I prevent that? And with SQL Server, basically you don't have to think about it. You set the isolation level, you're done. As long as you understand what kind of things can leak through from one transaction to another and code defensively against that, you don't have a problem.
I get what you're saying. There's this great advantage to transactability and efficiency of the T-SQL language, but is that then to say that we'd be better off coding everything in T-SQL and, you know, our business logic go into stored procs, that sort of thing?
Well, one of the things Jim Gray said, I don't know if you know Jim Gray. He's the guy who basically, he and Reuter wrote the book which really defined how transactions can possibly work mathematically. Up to that time, people weren't quite sure how to make sure you don't turn things into mush. And they provided the mathematical basis. And the basis basically says there's these various characteristics of locks. And if you put them together in the right way, you will not turn your data into mush. Codd, who invented relational databases, basically explained how you can't turn data into mush if one person at a time is using it. Gray and Reuter basically explained how you cannot turn data into mush while multiple people are using it. So the question is, how do you get performance out of it? That's always really the issue. And when you're not using a database, the problem is you're always trying to be really clever about how you go and touch your data. And the core of it all is you know how the data is being used. And when you do, you can take lots of shortcuts, obviously. And that's really the key.
So Dan, you did just a great job of boiling ideas down to their essence. And I know that one thing that people new to the SQL Server platform struggle with is understanding what all the different moving parts are. And I wonder if you could take us through those, the SS star S services.
Sure. Okay, there's a couple of services, and in fact, they're actually pretty much implemented as services too, though if you think of them at the kind of high level, they're services, whether they were really part of the same application or not. So one of the services we have, which has kind of a history to it, is integration services, SSIS. And one of the things that people found out with relational databases is they want to analyze their data, stuff typically called data mining. In the late 1980s, I think, or early 1990s, a scientist at IBM discovered you can figure out really weird things about the data you have if you look at it in a certain way. In fact, he even, I can't think of his name, but he even made the content. He was surprised that it actually worked, that you could actually understand things about your data just by looking at the concurrence of various kinds of things. Well, what people found out was with the relational database, typically what people use it for is to do lots of transactions that change things. For example, if you have a shopping cart, what's going on? Hopefully you have thousands of customers at the same time trying to go and buy things and take stuff out of stock. And you've got to process those things really quickly and not screw up. Unfortunately, when you go and analyze data, it's the antithesis of that. What you really want to do is make everything stop at this very instant in time and look at everything to see what's going on. You can't do that in a transactional database because in order to make what I call a coherent report of what's going on, one way or another, you have to freeze what's going on in the database, look at all the numbers, how they relate to each other, and then unfreeze it. You can't do that if people are banging on the database. So they understood in order to do this analysis stuff, we've got to move it into something else. So initially, there were these tools called ETL tools, extract, transform, and load tools. And what they did was to say, well, we want to pull the data out of our database, SQL Server, Oracle, whatever, move it into another database, but kind of change the way we're keeping track of it. One of the hallmarks of a relational database is that you don't put the same data in two places at once, because then there's a possibility they get out of sync with each other. Unfortunately, that's called normalization. Unfortunately, to make things go fast, sometimes you have to denormalize a little bit. To do analysis, you have to do tons of denormalization. So extract, transform, and load yanks the data out of your relational database in some way that's very quick. It knows the internal structure of the database, which COD says you shouldn't know, but they do. And then they move it someplace else. And while they're doing it, they transform it into this denormalized form. In effect, they make like partial queries so that then they can go and look at it and ask these things like, you know, how many people bought beer and shampoo on the same day at the same time? Because that's really interesting. Maybe we should put them on shelves next to each other. So the initial thrust for what ended up becoming SSIS was this idea that you had to rip data out of SQL Server much faster than you could do with a regular query, because it's a relational database, and then transform it into this denormalized form, sort of partial queries, so you could ask these management-level questions like, how many people buy beer and shampoo in the same order, that kind of thing. So that was the initial thing. And there was something called DTS, data transformations, that SQL Server used to have was COM-based. But then they realized, well, there's other things people want to do. They might want to go and take, for example, a report in the form of a spreadsheet and insert it into SQL Server as the current data, because maybe their remote offices go and write spreadsheets to, you know, say what happened during the day or something like that. They don't really have a real database there, and you want to import that into SQL Server. So that kind of was the genesis of integration services. How do I integrate data from tons of different sources and do things with them? And so now what SSIS is, you can sort of think of it as this thing that will take data from anywhere, maybe mung it up a little bit, and move it anywhere. In fact, you can use SSIS without using SQL Server at all. You can take data from a bunch of spreadsheets and turn it into a comma-separated variable report if you want. If you're going to work with databases, it's basically the fastest way to get data out of a database or into a database. And typically, what you end up doing to do this in SSIS, there are two principal constructs. One of them is familiar to people who do workflow, because there's something they call a control flow. What's a workflow? It's a bunch of tasks ordered in some way, maybe some conditionally executed, some not, maybe some branches. You basically make a flow chart of your program. That's what a workflow is. Right. That's what a control flow is in SQL, in integration services. So you have a control flow. One of the tasks in a control flow is something that's a bit different from what you think of in workflow. It's called a data flow. And a data flow basically says, I have a stream of data, and I want to work on each element, each basically in SQL Server. When you issue a query, you get something called a result set. And the characteristic of a result set is it's a number of streams of data running in parallel. Each stream always is the same data type. In other words, it's a stream of rows from the database. And what a data flow does is it takes streams of rows and processes them. It can do something as simple as saying, I want to throw rows 5 through 7 away and keep rows 1 through 4 and 10 through 15 and make a new flow. It can do other things a lot more sophisticated, like say, take columns 2 and 7, add them together and make a new column. So you can do this processing on data. And the neat thing about data flows is, and it's because it's easy to do in a data flow, you know when you can do things in parallel and you know when you can't. So in a data flow, if you have a bunch of streams being processed, you can typically process them all at once unless you're doing what's called an aggregation. For example, one of the elements in a data flow is, tell me the average value of everything coming into here. Well, you obviously have to read it all before you can output the value. But a lot of the data flows do things like, say, just go and look at these two columns and add them together. That you can do in sequence. And when you do that in integration services, every single data flow is in effect running on its own thread. It'll run as fast as it can. So as the basis for ETL, it allows you to write a program, a flowchart, which says how to go and get my data. In general, although it doesn't have to be this way, what the data flow is, how do I go and mung that data to get what I want? And it turns out data flows, when they work faster than anything else you can do. And then in the end, it says, I want to put it here. The classic use for it is, my input is a transactional database, my data flows among all the data and output it to another database, but it's going to be completely denormalized. And once you have a denormalized database, what you have is something called analysis services, SQL Server analysis services. And it turns out there's a bunch of algorithms you can use against a database that's been denormalized. There are things like called slowly changing variables, things that you want to say, this hardly doesn't change very often, but when it does, I'm really curious about it. There's other things you can do when you use analysis services, which basically say, well, find the things that are changing the most. Find the things that happen together at the same time the most. Sometimes it's called data mining. There's a bunch of mathematical algorithms that people have looked at, and again, based on math, not heuristics, that will pull data out of this denormalized data. And it turns out SQL Server Integration Services, I think at this point, has about a dozen of those predefined algorithms, and you can also make your own. So if you take a look at Integration Services, it's a way to take data from someplace, move it to another place, maybe change it along the way. The classic use is ETL, extract, transform, and load. Grab it from a transactional database, denormalize it, put it into what would normally be called an analysis services database, which is just a regular database that's been denormalized, and apply these analysis services algorithms to it to find out interesting facts. Like, for example, a lot of people buy beer and chair poo in the same order all the time. So those are two of the things we have, two of the, quote, services from SQL Server that are kind of high level. And those are actually done in such a way. In fact, a lot of people that are practitioners in integration services and analysis services don't necessarily know a lot about databases. They don't understand the intricacies of transactions and transactional processing. Not important to them. They're typically analyzing data and moving it. Well, once you go and take data and analyze it, what are you going to want to do with it next? You're going to want to report on it. And that's what reporting services are all about. And the problem with reports is there isn't one way to do it. You can't say, well, I'm going to make a spreadsheet. That might work for everybody. Somebody might go and have something like SharePoint set up, and they want to make reports that are interactive in SharePoint. You need some easy way to get it into that. Reporting service basically acts as a conduit between data sources, could be a database, could be a spreadsheet, could be nothing but a simple file, and some kind of report format, which could be as simple as a comma-separated variable file, could be a little bit more elegant, like a bunch of pages in an Excel spreadsheet, or it could be something as esoteric as a SharePoint service. And in fact, what the SharePoint service does is live reports. With reporting services, you can make a report which is either pre-calculated or something that SharePoint will come along and say, make it right now because I want to know what it is. Oh, and by the way, I want to be able to sort it on different columns interactively, and maybe when I get all done, I want a PDF. And all that stuff is built in at a high level into reporting services. And again, once again, reporting services is something the people who work with it may or may not know a lot about databases, but they know how to go and move things from one source into some other source. So those are the three, quote, big deal services that come with SQL Server. And SQL Server is a little bit strange. You think of those things as products, like, gee, I'd like to use reporting services, or gee, that ETL stuff is really use. I've got this Oracle database, and I want to go and move it over into this other database, which is going to use some third-party data mining thing. And wow, that's so easy to do with SSIS. I'd like to buy SSIS to do that. You can't. Basically, when you buy a SQL Server license, not the Express version, but the regular license, it includes licenses for all those things. And in fact, there are Oracle-only database houses who own SQL Server licenses just to use SSIS. Because it works so well and it's so fast, it's basically, you know, it's a really nice tool for moving things around. And then, of course, the fourth service in SQL Server is called the SQL Server Engine, which basically implements T-SQL, implements transactions. And if you take a look, SQL Server is implementing what's called a, quote, relational database. And sometimes people are, you know, wondering, what's a relational database? Why the heck do I care what it is? Well, if you take a look at the history of relational databases, first of all, what's a database? It's a pile of data. That's all it is. It's a pile of data. Classically, it was a bunch of piles of data in different files. And what people would do, you know, the big boss would say, well, I need a report on how salaries have been increasing over the last year. And people would write a program to take a look at these files to get this information. And then suddenly the big boss would say, you know, I'm going to want to see that report every month. And they're going to say, takes a long time to run. So what they would do is make some more things they called side files. Now we'd call them indexes. They'd scour all this stuff and make these side files to make this special report for the big boss run real fast. The problem with that was those side files could get out of sync with the real data because there was nothing forcibly holding them together. And then a scientist at IBM, Edwin Codd, looked at this and said, he was a mathematician, he said, you guys are working with sets of data. Don't you know set theory? And the answer was, no, they didn't know set theory. That was the problem. He said, I can solve all these things with set theory. And the thing about set theory is you have a pile of data, and the pile of data works one way, and you apply set theorems to it, and you never change the underlying data. So where there is no way the underlying data can get out of sync with itself. There's no way a side file can go and end up having pointers to things that don't exist anymore because somebody changed the underlying data without telling the programmer who made it the side file to make the report for the big boss run really, really, really fast. So he said, no, that's not what you want to do. In fact, I'm going to come up with a dozen, actually 13 rules that make up a database. And if you Google for Codd's rules, you'll find these 13 rules. But they're kind of common sense rules. What they say is you cannot know the underlying structure that the data is stored in. The only thing you can know is the language that accesses it. Now you can no longer fuss with the data directly. That's kind of like the key thing that makes it work. And then there's a number of other rules about how things have to work. In fact, one of the rules he has is, and the result of it was SQL, he said, you can have any kind of language, even a binary language, to go and manipulate your underlying data, but you have to include a text-based language. That means text in, text out to access this data. They can do everything you can do in your binary data. And what are all those things? Well, they're select, insert, update, and delete. That's what they are. Those are the things you have to be able to do with your language to be a relational database. So the whole idea of a relational database was to guarantee the integrity of the underlying data no matter what questions you asked it. Now, the problem was when IBM got this piece of gold, they didn't realize what they had, because the initial databases were like mind-numbingly slow because every time you made a query, they basically looked at all the data. Over the years, which is now 30 years or so, people have gotten a lot more clever. And what they do now is, and this is one of the reasons why DBAs don't want people doing arbitrary queries against the database, is if you look at the queries people are making, you can say, gee, I know an index to make. I'm not going to let you touch that index. I'm going to put it behind the scenes. I'm going to make an index that if you ask for that particular query, magic, the right kind of keys will be there. Oh, by the way, if you change something in the database because you can't ever touch the index directly, we'll automatically update it so it's always correct. It's always behind the scenes. And as a result, relational databases got to be really, really fast. But if you go and make an arbitrary query against a relational database, it can be really, really slow if there isn't an appropriate underlying index. And that's why you can't do the typical kinds of business intelligence queries against the relational database, because the indexes won't be there. They have to, in fact, to some extent, you can sort of think of indexes as denormalizing data because the same data is in more than one place, but you can only touch it in one place. So mathematically, that's okay. When you actually go and use ETL for analysis services, what then goes and happens is you really do go and denormalize it. You really do have data in multiple places where you could change it in one and screw things up. But in analysis services, you never do that. It's basically a snapshot in time. And then you start asking questions. So what SQL Server Engine is an implementation of a relational database, and it also implements the SQL language. SQL Server calls it Transact SQL. That's their implementation of SQL. And basically, it goes, that's the text-based language for talking to SQL Server. There really isn't any other. So those are the services you get with SQL Server. You get the database engine service. You get the integration services engine service. You get the analysis services engine. And you get the integration services engine. Those are really the four biggies in SQL Server. And again, one license gives you everything. You don't get pieces. It's not part smart.
I wonder if I could ask you to focused specifically on SQL Server analysis services. You described that as being, in effect, an implementation of a very large denormalized database.
And, correct.
You know, logically, we see that a little different. We talk about cubes. We talk about dimensions. And are those logical constructs on top of that denormalization? If so, what are those things and how do they manifest?
Well, when you go and make dimensions, you're basically, in fact, what they have are facts. You go and take your data and you extract facts from it. And the same, two different sets of facts, which facts can be, generally a fact is a table which is very narrow and very big. And the fact might be a sales transaction for $30 took place at this time, three columns. And then you have dimensions, and those tend to be small tables but wide, and they aggregate things about facts together. And so you may take that data about sales and have it in many different fact tables in different forms. You might have a fact table that says sale at this time took place and it was $3. You might have another one that says sale at this time took place and there were four items in it and things like that. When you go and make a cube, what you're doing is really taking three dimensions, three things which are built on facts, and putting them in three axes and saying, I'm going to nail down one axis, show me the two-dimensional view of the other two accesses. And that's the part that the big boss is going to do, in effect. He's going to have the cube, and he's going to want to say, well, I have a cube that basically has time of sale, amount of sale, and number of items in the sale. Those are the three dimensions. And he says, gee, I want to look at this based on time. And then in time, he can see basically layers of sales at a particular time and the number of items. And he says, oh, really what I want to do is look at this as number of items. So then he can look at, okay, these are all the sales that sold three items, and they happened at these times and these amounts. And you can see a two-dimensional graph of it. So it kind of, it's sort of like what they call inverting a database. That's another thing that people sometimes do. That's a different thing from when people had hierarchical databases. But once you do this stuff, it turns out there's a whole bunch of algorithms you can apply to your facts and your dimensions to extract various kinds of data that you might not have known was there.
And do I have to be very, very cognizant and deliberate about the destination structure in my SSAS database when I want to build reports on top of it?
Well, you do, in the sense that if the facts aren't there, you can't ask the query. So part of what you do with SSIS is, in effect, construct the fact tables that are going to make sense for the queries you're going to ask. In other words, you can't ask a generalized query if you don't know what's going to be, because there's all kinds of questions you could ask. So in general, you're going to go and build all these possible things offline, away from the transactional database, of course, based on the things you want to ask. But in fact, if you don't know what's going to be asked, you can't guarantee there'll be an answer that people want there. But in general, you just build a whole bunch of them.
SSIS gives me some tools to help me do that, to help me guess, or not guess, but in order to plan my SSAS structure.
Yeah, it basically allows you to go and implement, to do what you want. And actually, one of the things SSIS will do also is it will actually do some data mining for you. There are actually, you can use it against the analysis services database. There are some data mining tasks built into SSIS. So sometimes you use it for that. But the principal reason is to transform it into the fact tables that you want and whatever else you want. But again, SSIS is this incredibly generic tool for going and taking a bunch of data and turning it into something else. And an analysis service is one of those things that people use it for. They just don't, it's amazing what you can do with it. It's just that, and the tools are reasonably good for it. They're all very graphic, you know, and that sort of thing. And again, if you have a large amount of data that has to be moved and transformed, it's unlikely you'll be able to write a hand-coded program that will do it faster than SSIS will.
Well, we happen to also, Dan, be sitting on the cusp of delivery for SQL Server R2, or SQL Server 2008 R2, I believe. Is there anything in there that you're aware of that you're particularly looking forward to?
I haven't been tracking R2 that closely. So and my understanding is there is more analysis services stuff in there and some other things, but I just haven't been tracking it closely enough to get excited about it. Not as much as I tracked 2005 and 2008. Those were different things. But no, the R2 release, I just haven't been tracking very closely.
What was your big win favorite for 2008?
Well, 2008 wasn't as big a deal as from 2000 to 2005. There were two major changes in SQL Server. The up until the movement to 2005, the biggest major change was from SQL Server 6.5 to 7, and that's because the underlying structure that implemented SQL Server changed. It went from some custom-coded stuff based on the Sybase code to a COM implementation of SQL Server that allowed us to have old ADB and a bunch of other things. The transition from SQL Server 2000 to 2005 was another huge change in the underlying infrastructure. The fact that it allowed CLR code to run in the server is almost mind-numbing. One of the things that whenever you have a database, it never does what you want, so you always have to extend the capabilities. And traditionally, database engines have given us a couple of ways to do that. In Oracle, you do it with Java. In prior to 2005, you did it typically with C++ and some templates to go and build these OLADB things that got welded in. The trouble is, in the case of the OLADB stuff, you're writing code that runs in the engine, and if you screw it up, you will kill the server. In the case of Oracle, they got around that by running the Java out of the SQL process. So if you screw up your Java, your process will go down. You will not kill the database. When they went to 2005, the goal was, and it was realized, to run .NET code inside the server and not kill the server no matter what, to be no more dangerous than T-SQL. And they pulled that off, and they can do it because they can inspect so much about how .NET runs, because they can see what it's doing with the IL and all that. So that was a huge change. There were some other huge changes, too, in terms of some of the things that we got, to my mind, things like execution context. I'll talk about that in a second. The other big one was basically exceptions. Those, from a practical point of view, I think are the two biggies. Without the move to put the CLR inside the database engine is mind-numbing, and it works, and it's fantastic, and it's actually used for some of the things that are in 2008, and for example, some of the date formats and stuff like that, and the GIS stuff is all implemented in .NET. But two of the other things that were really kind of a pain in SQL Server was, if you were going to do what's called dynamic SQL, that is, you cobble up some text and say, please execute this for me. Prior to 2005, the person who executed that code had to have the underlying rights for all the objects that code touched. That's not true in static T-SQL. You do not have, if you write a stored procedure, someone else can execute that stored procedure who doesn't have rights to the tables it touches. That's why you write the stored procedure. When you go and write dynamic SQL, that user has to be able to have full rights to touch anything it touches, which means they can touch it without using that dynamic SQL. Huge problem. One of the things they added in 2005 is something called execution context. You can say, execute this code in the context of user blah, and it would have the rights of user blah, and you can say the user can't revert that. So now you can go and write dynamic SQL that acts the same way as a stored procedure does from a user's point of view. That is, they do not need to have access rights to the underlying things. The users whose context you execute in does have to have those rights, but they can't make use of them. So execution context is kind of a big deal, I think. The other big deal, again, to my mind, was the idea of having exceptions in T-SQL. In the past, if you wanted to go and manage errors, when you execute a SQL instruction, if there's an error, there's an error code you can recover from a server variable called @error. The trouble is, if you don't read that error immediately after the statement that created the error, it gets wiped out.
Right.
Which means if you want to totally control your errors, your code looks like statement, read @error, statement, read @error, you know, check it, do something, really ugly looking. People who write, you know, in C or C++ or C#, they know you can say try catch, and you don't have to inject that in the code. One of the things they added to T-SQL in 2005 were exceptions. There are try catch blocks, and they work exactly the same way, which means now you don't have to pollute your code in order to catch an exception and figure out what happened. And it added another thing, which was also really important. Prior to having exceptions, there were certain kinds of errors that had to be handled on the client. And the typical one, which gave people tons of heartburn, when you're writing transactions, you can't guarantee, there's no way to guarantee they can work. You might end up in something called a deadlock. That is where the result of two transactions, the typical case is one guy says, I want to lock this resource A. The other guy says, I want to lock resource B. Then resource, the first guy says, I want to lock B, and the other guy says, I want to lock A. It's a deadlock because one guy isn't going to release the other one. And that can happen when you write transactions. SQL Server can actually see that. In fact, it basically, in effect, polls transactions all the time to see, because it can look at the graph of the locks they're using, and they can say, deadlock. And it will arbitrarily go and kill one of the transactions and roll it back for you. The problem is, you can't catch that error on the server. It goes back to the client. And the client, if the application's smart enough to give the client the message, it says something like, you are the victim of a deadlock. You know?
Yeah.
You know, you immediately get a call to the help desk. I think there's a virus on my machine or something like that. And that should be handled on the server. Well, almost all of those errors, which traditionally would have broken the connection and caused the client to get that you victim of a deadlock sort of thing, are captured by a try-catch block. And they will go and allow you to go and say, oh, there was a deadlock. I'll handle it on the server. The normal way of handling a deadlock is to just run the transaction again. 99.999% of the time, it's one of those crazy Fig Newtons that just happens at a certain time, and they have to line up perfectly so the second time you execute it, it just works. So, and again, they don't happen very often, so that's the worst kind of error because you don't have experience with it. Now you can handle all that kind of stuff on the server. Unfortunately, that same thing introduced something else brand new that didn't exist before, and it's something called an uncommittable transaction. What the heck is that? How can I have a transaction I can't commit? Well, if you have a try block and a catch block in T-SQL, and you get one of these errors, like a deadlock, for example, what happens is you're at a point in your transaction flow where you can't commit the transaction. Obviously, you're the victim of a deadlock. You can't commit it. And what that really means is you can't execute any code which would change the state of the database, because that goes into what's called the transaction log. That's what makes transactions work so they can recover. That's your compensating resource manager. That's how you figure out how to undo things and all that. So you can get at a point in your flow where the only thing you can do is call rollback transaction, and you have to physically do that in your code. And the reason it doesn't do it automatically for you is you might want to do a couple of poking around, some selects and stuff before you do that, and then you have to say rollback transaction. So you can have this weird thing called an uncommittable transaction that couldn't happen before. So anyhow, those to my mind are the two big deal things that basically kind of put T-SQL on parity with the things that traditional C-sharp or C++ or Java programmers are used to having in their toolkit. They don't have anything like finally, though, but that usually isn't a big deal because of the way T-SQL works. But we've got try-catch, and we've got the ability to have this execution context. In fact, for example, let me just talk about a pet peeve of mine, and it's something you have to do. If you have a web server accessing a database, what does it do? Well, you give the web server an identity to access the database, and that identity typically has access to everything in that database, typical sort of things you do. And the result is you have to worry about SQL injection attacks. Some user goes and sends you something which causes you, maybe it's direct SQL, maybe it's something that causes your server-side support to generate a weird query that goes over to the server and it breaks the execution loop so it can go and do something it's not supposed to do. And so there's all these tools to go and parse the query on the fly to make sure it doesn't have a semicolon in it or whatever they're looking for.
And we use parameterized queries and commands and stuff too, right?
That's actually the thing you normally should do. But if you think about it, what does a parameterized query do? Think about this for a second. Maybe you know, but I'm just curious. Do you know what a parameterized query ends up doing?
So I actually don't know, but I've always assumed something, and I bet you're going to tell me I'm wrong.
Okay.
What I've always assumed it did was did some sort of runtime check within the library of the parameterized query itself. So the query object would be responsible for validating that its parameters are valid and safe, and then it just simply generates the T-SQL as it normally would get strung together for execution. Is that?
Nope, that's not what it does.
It's not what it
actually.
Okay.
No, that's not. keep in mind the language we have to talk. You're partially right. It does make the T-SQL. In the end, it has to send text to C-SQL. What it actually does is dynamic SQL. In SQL Server, there's a command called execute SQL, and you give it text and it executes it. One of the things you can do with that is instead of putting things like the parameters as literal text in the command, you can actually make them parameters. When you do SP execute SQL, it can have an arbitrary number of parameters. You know, when you call a stored procedure, you can basically have an arbitrary number of parameters in that. And the thing is, the things that go in the parameters cannot be commands. So if you put in something funny that looks like the name of the table, but if you parse it wrong, it ends up being, you know, a delete master or something. What it does is it basically turns it into an SP execute SQL command, but the things that are parameters in SP execute SQL, which means they cannot be interpreted as a command on the server. That's all it does.
I see. So it passes the responsibility for safety all the way down to SQL Server.
Absolutely. And in fact, if you wanted to, you could do the same thing, except that it's much easier to just make a parameterized command, parameterized query, to make it do that for you. But here's the other thing. That still doesn't change the fact that your identity on your web server typically has access to everything. And so you got to be kind of careful. And if you screw up your code, you might go deleting things you shouldn't. Well, one of the things that EFCOD said was everything about security in the database, in the relational database, has to be in the database. So anybody who connects to the database cannot possibly do anything they are not allowed to do. Physically impossible. That's how your relational database has to work. So why is there a problem with a web server? Well, the problem is, classically, the way that works is the user connects to the database and his permissions are associated with his identity. Unfortunately, the overhead of making a connection is horrendous. So if you have 1,000 people using your web server, you cannot make connections for each one of them. It will not work. In fact, the reason you have the single identity accessing the database is for reasons of scalability, no other reason. It's a nice way to scale the database out to lots of users. One of the things we now have with execution context is you can turn that on its ear. Execution context takes hardly any extra state. So what you can do is basically look at all the roles your user will be in, create identities on the server for each one of those roles, and then when that user executes their query, you execute it as, in the context of, one of these users on the database that can't touch things they aren't supposed to touch. For example, typically, a lot of these things are queries that are going to go and do selects on the database. They're only going to read the data.
I suppose some classic examples of where the roles would come into play would be, say, a non-logged in user, a logged in user, and an application administrator.
Correct. Yeah, those would be. But again, these aren't really roles. Roles are something else. SQL Server also has this thing called an application role, but it's a bit hard to make it really work nicely. I'm calling it a role. It's really an identity that has permissions associated with it. So you might have an identity called clerk that can only read the tables. So when you execute that user's query, you execute it as user clerk with no revert, meaning the code that goes in there can't switch back to the original identity. Which means if somehow or other that user manages to screw up your application on the web server to do an insert, it won't work anyhow. In other words, you're leveraging the fact. In fact, this is another sore point. Not that there's any way around it. The whole point of what COD said was having the security for the database in the database. So a user cannot possibly do anything he doesn't have permission to do. Whenever you use a web server where it has an identity, what you're doing is the database is delegating its responsibility to protect the data out to the web server. And web servers are just nowhere near as smart as the database. But now with execution context, you can actually leverage the security that's in the database without having to pay the overhead of making an actual connection for a particular user. So that's kind of neat. Now, it's not 100% perfect because if somebody manages to invade your server, and your server's compromised, of course they can get around that execute as stuff because, you know, they're in control. They control the horizontal. They control the vertical. You're toast already. But most of the time, that's a pretty good strategy. And if you do that with, like, checking for injection attacks, it's like belt and suspenders, you know. You're doing two levels of things which have not a lot of overhead. but kind of leave you in good shape. So again, the two big deal things in 2005, to my mind, or I would say the three big deal things, were execution context, try-catch, and the CLR operating inside of SQL Server. And again, going back to Jim Gray, and do you know who Jim Gray is?
He's a big deal guy.
He worked, I think, originally at IBM. I forget. But he is the guy who defined what transactions are. The things we call transactions today, Jim Gray defined. He worked at IBM. He worked at DEC on their original database, RDB, which has a very similar model to what Oracle has today. And then he was a scientist at Microsoft Research, working on stuff. And he was the guy who died in the sailboat accident. I don't know if you know the story. It's really sad.
Yes.
He is, you know, he's like, he is like up there almost with EF Cod when it comes to relational databases. He looked at the stuff that SQL people were doing with C-sharp, or I should say .NET inside the database. He says, yeah, this is what we need. This is the last key to making, you know, SQL Server an application engine. This is what we want. You can't do everything in T-SQL. You just can't. It's so much easier to do things like regular expressions in C-sharp. It's so much easier, you know, to calculate the value of pi in C-sharp, things like that. And so now we kind of have everything. You can mix back and forth. And again, the key thing about C-sharp in SQL Server, or I should say .NET, I don't want to be a bigot here, .NET in SQL Server, is the fact that it is just as safe as using T-SQL in SQL Server in terms of the damage it can do. It's not like what using using C++ with an extended stored procedure, which can cream anything. It can't do it. So it's really potent stuff. And in fact, one of the things I did, Bob Boscheman, I don't know if you know him or not, he and I wrote the course at Development Mentor on SQL Server 2005, and we did it with help from Microsoft, and we were actually teaching it during the alpha phase at Microsoft. And the thing all the DBAs asked when we taught that course, when we hit the CLR part, their question always was, how can I turn it off? And eventually they caught on, it's not the same as extended stored procedures. You don't have to turn it off. It's the same level of danger as T-SQL is. They can't go and blow up the server. So anyhow, so those are basically the three key things in 2005 in terms of, and the engine itself was a major change in terms of the implementation of the engine going from 2000 to 2005. In fact, that was the biggest change in SQL Server ever, and the preceding big one was from 6.5 to 7.0. So anyhow, that's the big deal picture on what's going on in SQL Server over the years.
Well, Dan, thank you so much, and I'm sure that there are a lot of folks who deal with SQL Server on a daily basis who have never had the level of insight into it that you just provided us. And I know I appreciate it. It was great.
Thank you. Thank you.
And I'm also going to be very interested to learn how many people caught that reference to horizontal and vertical control.
Oh, yes. That will be interesting. Yes. Yes, absolutely. I'm glad that you did. That makes me feel so good.
For those of you without the maturity of both Dan and I, this is for you.
There is nothing wrong with your television set. Do not attempt to adjust the picture. We are controlling transmission. If we wish to make it louder, we will bring up the volume. If we wish to make it softer, we will tune it to a whisper. We will control the horizontal. We will control the vertical. We can roll the image, make it flutter. We can change the focus to a soft blur or sharpen it to crystal clarity. For the next hour, sit quietly and we will control all that you see and hear. We repeat, there is nothing wrong with your television set. You are about to participate in a great adventure. You are about to experience the awe and mystery which reaches from the inner mind to the outer limits.
We want the Pluralcast to be your favorite technical program. And if it's not, that's a problem. And I want to hear about it. So send us a line over at cast.pluralsight.com, where you can suggest to us the kind of stories that you would like to hear, or even tell us your story yourself. This has been your host, David Starr, and I'm looking forward to next time where we can together see what we can learn on the Pluralcast.